edition here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Lauren Freyer. Good morning. This hour, how an Afghan national accused in the shooting of National Guard troops in D.C. actually got training in the past from the CIA. We'll talk swing state economics in Wisconsin, and we'll take you on a road trip through the Israeli-occupied West Bank.
So these are the skyscrapers of Jerusalem right in front of us. And then what are these buildings?
Settlement all around us.
Plus how Jamaicans feel about climate change after Hurricane Melissa and some joy with the Harry Potter full cast audiobooks and the puzzle. It's Sunday, November 30th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with a special edition of the Up North Report.
Everybody get their own baseline. Get manganese tested on your water.
Tracy, if I can, this is a point I should jump in.
People in the audience of an overflowing Emily City Council chambers last week occasionally interjected and applauded as members heard an update on a potential manganese mining operation. Councilmember Dan Brennan was the one who jumped in at this moment, directing questions to North Star Manganese CEO Rick Sandry. Sandry was at the meeting to share the latest updates on a project that's been on the table for at least 17 years. A third-party study of a possible mine, known as a preliminary economic assessment, shows that not only is it financially viable, but it could make back its investment in less than 2 years. There's a whole heap of steps that the company needs to undertake now. Sandry likened the report to them having graduated kindergarten. There's pre-feasibility reports and feasibility reports and environmental testing, not to mention a likely many years-long permitting process before a mine could open. But what the people of Emily want to know is, when are they going to test the drinking water? And is that water in danger of contamination if an underground mine were to be built? Brennan joined the council in 2024, but he's long been a part of the Emily Mine Information Group, a citizen organization conducting its own research. He says the group took on testing on its own when it became clear that promises weren't being kept by those involved in the exploration before North Star Manganese.
It seems to me that more can be being done to assess the impacts here as well as for you and your bottom line.
Well, that's where the next phase of our activity is to do that. Had we come up with a bad answer on a PEA, we would be telling everybody thank you very much for allowing us to participate up here, pick up our shoes and go somewhere else to look for another project.
Some of the first exploratory drilling in Emily occurred decades ago in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Various drilling efforts by different mining companies, including in 2023 by North Star, gave insight into what was locked deep below the earth, billions of pounds of rich manganese ore. An accelerated push toward clean energy alternatives and a growing market for electric vehicles and other battery-powered technologies reignited interest in the site's potential. Manganese is one of the metals used in battery production, combined with nickel and cobalt to increase energy storage capacity. While the element is one of the most plentiful on the planet, a small sliver appears to be pure enough for battery use, and signs so far point to Emily's deposit containing that high-quality ore. If the mine moves forward, it would be the only such operation on the continent in a marketplace where most of the mining is happening in Africa and processing in China. The report predicts the mine lifespan would be at least 23 years, producing 400,000 tons of manganese annually. Mayor Tracy Jones asked Sandry to explain in the simplest terms possible what the benefits would be for Emily residents.
You know, 25 years of activity here that people will be buying from the ACE, going to the, you know, local restaurants and things of that sort. So that kind of base.
He also pointed to cash payments per ton of material, a plethora of taxes levied by the state that benefit the local governments, and about 100 high-paying mining jobs. 30-year councilmember Gary Hansen, who described himself as among the skeptics, responded.
But Rick, you got to keep in mind, no amount of money replaces what we have here.
This is... And I fully support that.
Sandry said he views this project as his parting legacy in a long career, and it's important to him to get it right.
I'm an environmentalist that's in the mining industry. I believe that things need to be done correctly to be able to utilize the assets that God gave us on this planet. But I believe we should utilize the assets. So I come from that side of the use. And I don't want it to be my reputation or on my tombstone that I caused issues at Emily.
There's more to this story. Find photos and diagrams and more at KAXE.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Weekend edition from NPR News. Aisha Roscoe is away. I'm Lauren Freyer. President Donald Trump heads back to Washington after spending Thanksgiving at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. He's been posting about Afghan nationals and immigration following the attack last week on two National Guard members near the White House. It was an attack that fatally wounded one of them. Additionally, Trump has said that Venezuela's airspace is closed. NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram joins us now. Good morning, Deepa.
Hey there.
So first, a fact check. Can the U.S. president close another country's airspace?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question, Lauren, because we don't really have a lot of details or follow-up from the White House about this social media post from Trump that came over the weekend. And all the president said is that the airspace, quote, above and surrounding Venezuela should be considered closed in its entirety. And his post was addressed to airlines, pilots, drug dealers, and human traffickers. And that's pretty much all we've heard. No other details or any clarification. Is this new policy? You know, what did the president mean by this? Bottom line, though, is that the president does not have the authority to close another country's airspace, though I will note that recently the FAA, which is the Federal Aviation Administration, they did warn that airspace over Venezuela could potentially be hazardous, but that doesn't mean that the airspace is closed.
Well, how has Venezuela responded?
Yeah, the Venezuelan government, you know, said it forcefully rejects the president's statement. They called it a colonial threat that undermines Venezuela's sovereignty. Really no mincing words there. And you know, keep in mind, this is what's important. This is all coming as the U.S. has conducted multiple strikes on boats in the Caribbean Sea, the Eastern Pacific, on these boats that the U.S. government says are carrying drugs. And dozens of people have been killed in these strikes. And then on top of that, Trump has also recently indicated that the U.S. would stop drug traffickers by land as well. And he recently declared the government of Nicolas Maduro, who leads Venezuela, as a terrorist organization. So the tension on this issue has really escalated here.
Deepa, switching gears, Trump said that he was requesting 500 more National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. following that shooting last week. Is that happening?
Right. So the president announced he was going to add 500 more National Guard troops, like you said, to D.C. This happened shortly after the attack on Guard members outside the White House, nearby the White House earlier this week. That plan appears to remain in place. Those 500 new Guard members will join about the 2,000 Guard members who are already in the city. And there is a new development, though, from the weekend, which is that the government has also declared that every group of National Guard members patrolling Washington, D.C. D.C. will also be accompanied by at least one D.C. police officer. The details of this a little unclear, but a police officer who spoke to NPR on the condition of anonymity said that D.C. PD officers would be getting paid overtime to do this work, so it's not taking away from their regular police duties. But how this exactly will shake out when this kicks off, we don't know those details quite yet.
And the suspect accused of shooting those two National Guard members is an Afghan national, according to authorities. He lived in Washington state. And now the president says he wants more restrictions on immigrants because of this shooting. What exactly does President Trump want to do?
Yeah, well, the president, you know, posted on social media on his platform, Truth Social, and he said that he wants to, quote, permanently pause migration from all third world countries to allow the U.S. system to fully recover. He commented that reverse migration is the answer here. In the immediate aftermath of that shooting, you know, Trump said that he wanted every Afghan who entered to the U.S. after U.S. troops pulled out of Kabul in 2021, he wanted them to be reexamined. And remember, this happened in the Biden administration, so he's laying a lot of blame on former President Joe Biden. There really isn't much detail about what that means, the timeline of this, who would be in charge. There's already a lot of security, stringent examination of people who are coming into this country. They are being vetted, but all asylum decisions just in the last day or two have been halted to ensure more vetting and screening, and that's what the president is hoping for.
And the president and lawmakers come back this week to another pressing problem that has yet to be resolved, and that's the extension of the enhanced subsidies for Obamacare. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, remember that this was the issue that really propelled the government to shut down just a month ago. Right now, Congress is pretty divided on how to do it. There's even some division among GOP members. I think the thing to watch out for, though, is to see how the White House and President Trump will weigh in on this, because Republicans, like I said, aren't really on the same page here.
That's NPR's White House correspondent Deepa Shivaran. Thanks so much, Deepa.
Thanks.
And as we just mentioned, the suspect in last week's shooting of two National Guard members is an Afghan national. He also had high-level military training, training that he received from the U.S. government, specifically the CIA. For more on this, we're joined now by Steve Call, senior editor at The Economist and author of multiple books about Afghanistan and the intelligence community. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So this suspect, Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, was allegedly part of one of the so-called zero units. What can you tell us about those units?
Well, they evolved out of the CIA's role in the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks. Of course, the principal reason that the U.S. went into Afghanistan was to attack and disrupt al-Qaeda, the stateless terrorist group that was based in Afghanistan and that carried out the 9/11 assaults. And to do that, once they got on the ground, the CIA recruited local militias to fight al-Qaeda units and their allies in the eastern mountains of Afghanistan, primarily also in the south of Afghanistan. So these groups evolved into something called, formally, the counter-terrorist pursuit teams. They were militias. They were recruited on the basis of tribal or social identity, extended family. They were trained, armed, and paid directly by the CIA. They never became part of the Afghan government that evolved after the U.S. invasion, and they operated in alliance with that government, but under CIA advice and with CIA support. They became called the Zero Units because over time their mission evolved and their size grew, and some of the units were designated as 03, 02, and so forth.
Hmm. And what kind of reputation did they have? Some human rights groups have called them death squads, though the CIA, I think, has disputed that characterization.
Yes, I mean, they were lethal. They were trained to attack specific terrorist targets for the most part. They started out focused on al-Qaeda. As the war changed, their mission changed, and they became involved in the war against the Taliban when the Taliban, the guerrilla movement that was overthrown by the United States in late 2001, it revived itself, of course, and by 2007 or so, it was waging a full-scale insurgency. And at that stage, a lot of the war was being carried by American troops that came in, their Afghan allies in the formal army that were being trained up, but these zero units were kind of the sharp edge of the spear. Human rights groups did report on atrocities that were attributed to these groups. The CIA often said that this was just Taliban propaganda. But what we do know is that they were highly effective and cohesive, and the Taliban feared them more than any other unit in the war. And indeed, at the end of the war, during the evacuation, the Taliban wanted these units, which now numbered about 10 to 12,000 men under arms, so they were not small in size, they wanted them out of Afghanistan because while they could absorb a lot of the Afghan army and incorporate it into a new Taliban regime, they didn't think that they could digest these groups that they'd been fighting so viciously for so long.
And in August 2021, as you mentioned, the Taliban retook Afghanistan. You know, I remember those chaotic scenes of the U.S. pulling out. So what did happen to these elite Afghan units that were left behind?
Well, they weren't left behind. They ended up being evacuated. So as you'll recall, in that chaotic spring and summer, a lot of the Afghan army and even some of its elite units dissolved. They defected. They left the country. They went home, they turned tail they turned sides and fought for the Taliban. The Zero units and some other commando units were about the only part of the Afghan armed forces that held together right to the end. And so some of these Zero units during the last days were evacuated from their forward bases in the east and the south to Hamid Karzai International Airport, the scene of the chaotic evacuation. And they were put to work providing security. First, they cleared the airfield of civilians who were charging through the fences, and then they provided perimeter security down to the last days of the evacuation. The Biden administration made a decision somewhat late to put them on the planes and to evacuate them. And so they were allowed also to bring family members. The typical figure that's given for the total evacuation of Afghans from that August chaos is about 120,000 thereabouts. And what we now know is that tens of thousands of that number was made up of these Zero units and people that they had brought in as their relatives.
Could or should the U.S. have handled that differently?
These were the closest allies that the United States had among them. They faced retribution if they stayed in Afghanistan. The Taliban had made clear they wanted them to leave, so it was a decision that was made late. They weren't brought directly to the United States. They were brought to other countries, then vetted, and many of them were then admitted to the United States.
That's journalist Steve Call of The Economist. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. KAXE News is working on a story explaining the complex workings behind your property taxes, but we need your help. Share your property tax statement and your questions with us by emailing news@kaxe.org. These real-world examples will help everyone better understand how and why you may be seeing your taxes rise. The Iron Range Area Council of Minnesota Chippewa Tribes has their annual Christmas party Thursday, December 4th at 6 p.m. at Marble City Hall. Enjoy a potluck dinner and native bingo. The Grand Rapids Area Library Fund has been established at the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. The goal is to raise $300,000 by September 1st, 2026. Funds will be earmarked for the library's 2027 budget. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. In Hong Kong, authorities say the death toll has risen to 146 in a massive apartment blaze that erupted Wednesday and burned for more than 2 days. Investigators have been combing through a block of seven large buildings. Authorities say a gunman killed four people late Saturday afternoon at a family gathering in Stockton, California. Several people were wounded. Police are searching for a suspect in what they believe may have been a targeted incident. On this big holiday travel Sunday, the forecast is for heavy snow in parts of the Midwest. Hundreds of flights out of Chicago have been canceled since yesterday. Mainly rain is in the forecast for the East Coast. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. And from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer. During the Gaza war, there's also been violence in the other Palestinian territory, the occupied West Bank. In addition to killings and arrests, which Israel says are for its own security, Israel has also been redistricting land there. It's the same land Palestinians want for a future state. I'm just back from the West Bank, where I saw big changes on the ground. We begin at a Palestinian elementary school with walls painted pink. Children sing the Palestinian national anthem at morning assembly in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The students are here, but the teachers are late. Delayed at this Israeli military checkpoint.
Hello. Boker Tov, good morning.
Where the rules keep changing. First, we needed ID cards. Now we need permits, says teacher Sahar Mansour. My producer Nuha Musleh and I rode to school with her and another teacher, Dina Raddad.
So this is where you live, this hill over here, and this is where you work.
To see what their commute is like.
It's beautiful land here. Ancient terracing, some olive trees, and you can see Jerusalem in the distance.
And how it's changed since the Gaza war. Raddad says it's been taking an hour and a half to get through this one checkpoint. Sometimes when she's leaving work in the evening, the Israeli soldiers just shut the gate, she says, and she's been stranded, unable to get home.
I mean, it's probably 500 yards. Nothing. Could walk there in 5 minutes.
This fall, Israel declared the town where these teachers work, called Beit Iksa, part of a seam zone, a closed military zone on the seam or border between Jerusalem and the West Bank. In a statement to NPR, the military confirmed that any movement in or out of this zone requires a permit. It's to safeguard the citizens of Israel, it says. For Palestinians, it's gridlock. Construction workers, teachers, there's a water tanker here all waiting to pass, says Hussein Hababe, the deputy mayor. He's out at this checkpoint every morning.
So it's a digital permit you have on your mobile.
Troubleshooting permits, negotiating with soldiers. He fears these new rules are the start of annexation. The Israelis, he says,
they want the land and they don't want the people.
NPR asked the Israeli military if the deputy mayor is right. It did not respond. In October, far-right Israeli lawmakers won a preliminary vote in parliament to annex the West Bank, take it over completely, make it part of Israel. Vice President J.D. Vance called the vote a very stupid political stunt. The Israeli government says annexation is not official policy. But many Palestinians believe it actually began decades ago with the first Israeli checkpoints, restrictions, and settlements, and that it's being finalized now in this cluster of villages in a very strategic location.
So we're driving through this sort of crescent moon of nine villages around Jerusalem. There are goats and olive groves, and Dina says there's a... Here's a water project, these big pipes here. But you think these are not for the villagers?
The pipes are for a new Israeli settlement, says teacher Dina Radat. The United Nations has called on Israel to stop adding settlements, but says the pace of building has nevertheless accelerated.
The next hill is ringed with all these modern buildings, different architectural style, and that's how you can tell it's an Israeli settlement. Just right in front of us here. Dina, when you were a child, could you look straight across into Jerusalem there?
This was the old gateway to Jerusalem, she says, and it still is for Israeli settlers. About 500,000 of them live in the West Bank. The seam zone unites them with Jerusalem, while Palestinians from the West Bank, more than 3 million people, are no longer allowed to visit the city that they want as their capital. This is Road 60, one of the main highways that runs the length of the West Bank. And on either side of the road, Israeli construction vehicles, bulldozers, are clearing huge swaths of terraced farmland.
1994, they took the 14 dunam.
That terraced land was in Imad Basha's family for centuries. In 1994, Israel confiscated some of it to build this highway. And Basha says he was okay with that. The new road would be good for property values, he thought. But over time, he realized that this highway has no exits to Palestinian towns. Only to Israeli settlements. And now Israel has seized more of his land to create what the military calls a buffer zone alongside the highway. Standing in what's left of his grandparents' olive grove, Basha, a grandfather now himself, breaks down crying. Little by little, he's been deprived, he says, of his land, his ability to move around, and of his dignity. During the two-year Gaza war, official Palestinian figures show Israel seized about as much West Bank land, tens of thousands of acres, as it did in the 10 years preceding. Back in that elementary school in the seam zone, the principal, Arwa Thaher, is dashing between classrooms, juggling lessons. How can I run a school without teachers, she asks. She lives locally, and so does the English teacher, Fatima Hababe, a relative of the deputy mayor we heard from earlier. But Hababe's daughter commutes to medical school through that checkpoint, and delays are hurting her grades, her mother says.
And my children, they said to me, we want to leave this village, you know, just because we can't waste time. They came yesterday tired, exhausted.
So she's thinking of moving out of the seam zone to a different part of the West Bank.
This village, I love it. I grew up here.
And where would you go?
To Ramallah, to live freely. We are humans.
This year, Israeli troops displaced tens of thousands of Palestinians from refugee camps in the West Bank. But for every person forcibly displaced, there may be someone like Fatima Hababe, who's thinking of leaving voluntarily as life gets more difficult. Before we say goodbye, she takes me up to the roof of the school.
Wow. So these are the skyscrapers of Jerusalem right in front of us. And then what are these buildings?
Settlement all around us.
We look out at a landscape that's changed so much while all eyes were on Gaza. Fatima says she wants to freeze time right here.
Honestly, this is my dream, to just sit and look at the views. This is my dream. I can't now look at the future.
She can't bear to look at the future, she says. She just looks at tomorrow. A Affordability, that's a word we will hear a lot of for the next 12 months. It's what voters say is a top concern, and it could be consequential in the swing state of Wisconsin. Reporters Chuck Quirnbach and Mayan Silver with member station WUWM join us now from Milwaukee. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what are you both hearing from voters?
How costs of living are affecting people? I stopped by a turkey giveaway where people talked about struggling with basic needs and really what they want politicians to do about it.
Yeah, and I've been talking with folks about the Affordable Care Act and the expectation here that for hundreds of thousands of people covered under this Obama-era law, health care will be less affordable next year.
And Chuck, you've been following some of the events that Democrats are already holding around the state about health care affordability. What are they focusing on?
Well, the prediction that premiums are going up in January and that subsidies, including a federal tax credit that the state of Wisconsin says saves the average CARE Act enrollee about $650 per month, may expire at the end of December. About 275,000 people here could be affected. One of them, freelance writer Nancy Pesky, spoke at a news conference held by Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. Pesky says she may also have to pay additional costs for her son, who just landed a job with no health coverage.
So he's going to have such an astronomical premium that I'm probably going to have to pay that too. So, yeah, it's going to be very tight.
That's one concern. There's also the cost of living in general. Mayan, what are you hearing from some of the people you spoke with at this food giveaway that you mentioned?
Yeah, there were plenty of people in line at the turkey giveaway who directly blamed Trump for rising costs, who said they'd be voting for Democrats. But I also found some people who said they didn't foresee voting. I talked to Cheryl Britton. She's a 57-year-old who's been struggling financially. She gets food stamps, is on supplemental security income, and these days she's sleeping in a van. She used to vote for Democrats, but now says she's fed up with all politicians.
The Trump administration, Democrat, Republican, liberal, white wing, left wing, back wing, horizontal wing, I don't give a freak. Get your stuff together, period.
Britton doesn't plan to vote until, in her opinion, politicians stop focusing on the 1% and start thinking more about people like her.
And if voters like her stay home, that could really matter for congressional races. Chuck, tell us about some of those.
Well, the GOP has a 6-2 majority in House seats here, with Democrats hoping next year to unseat Republican Derek Van Orden in western Wisconsin and Brian Stile in a district south of Milwaukee. Also, Republican House member Tom Tiffany from northern Wisconsin is running for governor. It's an open seat as Democratic incumbent Tony Evers is retiring. Van Orden, Stile, and Tiffany have all criticized the ACA, or Affordable Care Act. The hazard in doing so is that, according to a recent polling by Marquette University, 58% of Wisconsin voters back extending the CARE Act subsidies. But the polling also says the GOP Congress member's stance seems to be in line with the views of the majority of Republican voters here. Brian Norby runs an engineering firm and is chairman of the Jefferson County Republican Party west of Milwaukee. Norby says the ACA's enhanced tax credits are a political football.
Now they're essentially being used as a political tool to heighten up the Democratic base to come out and vote. So why should we continue to extend them when they're designed by the Democratic Party?
Okay, so President Trump won Wisconsin by just under 30,000 votes, in large part because of these pocketbook issues. And now, 1 year later, NPR polling shows that nearly 6 in 10 Americans say the Trump administration should focus on lowering prices. Mayan, what are you hearing from Trump voters about this?
So some Trump voters I talked to said that economic woes, for instance, the effect of the government shutdown, were exaggerated. Others told me their budgets are tight sometimes, but they generally gave a lot of grace to Trump and his administration. That includes Aaron Eckhart. He's the president of a home building company. He's also a Republican who voted for Trump. And he says of the economy,
so I think it's turning around.
So you think that President Trump is delivering on the promises that he made to make life more affordable?
Correct. Promises made, promises kept.
Other Republicans I spoke with say that Trump had only been in office this term for a year and that he could still right the ship.
So is affordability going to stay a strong issue in Wisconsin for the next, 11 months until the election? Chuck?
Well, it might depend on what, if anything, the White House and congressional Republicans come up with on the Affordable Care Act. Senate Republicans have promised to vote on extending the subsidies by next month. Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin says she's willing to work with, quote, any Johnny-come-lately to help families avoid higher costs come January 1st.
And when it comes to higher costs overall, I'd say that Wisconsin is really a tale of two states, urban and rural, red and blue. And while voters around the state are concerned with prices, some really have unique concerns. There's manufacturers around the state grappling with tariffs. There's Wisconsin's big agricultural center. It's the dairy state that everyone knows about, but it also has a sizable soybean, corn, ginseng crops. So it's also the number one cranberry producing state in the country, which is really relevant for this time of year. These farmers and rural voters have long been loyal backers of President Trump, but in part because of tariffs, Democrats are really trying to make inroads there.
That's Mayan Silver and Chuck Quernbach of NPR member station WUWM in Milwaukee. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Overdose deaths are down dramatically across much of the country, and no one knows exactly why, but Worcester, Massachusetts offers clues. Martha Biebinger from member station WBUR has this report.
A few years ago, Worcester had one of the highest rates of overdose deaths in New England. Then last year, police reported a startling reversal, 49% fewer people dying after an OD. What changed? Let's start with a van that delivers treatment on city streets. A local addiction program called Spectrum parks a mobile clinic behind a Catholic church. Trina, a 60-year-old former nurse, comes here for her daily dose of a cherry red medicine called methadone.
I get 50 milligrams. I try not to go up. Thank you.
Methadone helps patients like Trina resist cravings for fentanyl. It's been around for decades, but most patients have to find their way to a designated methadone clinic every morning to get their dose. What's new for Worcester is bringing methadone right to Trina, or very close.
From where I live, I can throw a rock almost. I love the people in here. I see people very sick coming in here, getting put on it quickly, and then they have hope.
Trina says with methadone, she feels like her life is worth something again. NPR agreed not to use Trina's full name because she still occasionally buys illegal drugs.
My biggest saving grace is not hating myself anymore, not detesting my existence. That's where I'm doing good.
A hospital in Worcester runs another van that offers a different addiction treatment drug and stocks ambulances with that medication. But even with easier access to treatment, people still overdose. So Worcester made a second change last year. It blanketed overdose hotspots with a drug that can bring people back to life.
Narcan nasal spray is an emergency treatment designed to rapidly reverse the effects of a life-threatening opioid emergency.
Now, Narcan is available at libraries, train stations, and parks.
Narcan is the biggest thing that we've had in Worcester that has caused the decrease in overdose mortality.
This is Worcester's recently retired Commissioner for Health and Human Services, Dr. Maddie Castile.
We talk about Narcan as being like CPR, and everybody needs to carry it and know how to use it.
Worcester made a third big change last year, one that offers a surprising theory about why fewer people are dying from overdose. Street outreach workers like Kevin Davila started testing samples of illegal drugs.
Yes, I'm cleaning the machine to make sure there's nothing on it.
Davila wipes down this $55,000 drug checking machine and reaches for another client sample.
They think they bought fentanyl, but when we test it, does it come out as fentanyl?
In fact, this sample contains the animal tranquilizer xylazine. 64% of samples tested last year in Worcester included traces of xylazine. Here's why that matters. Xylazine can put someone in a deep slumber for 8 hours, much longer than fentanyl alone. So people taking xylazine use drugs less often. Tracy Green oversees the street drug checking program in Massachusetts.
This doesn't mean that there's zero risk. It just means there's potentially less fentanyl or fewer opportunities to overdose.
Xylazine is awful in its own way, creating deep wounds and infections. Drug checking has helped doctors understand xylazine-related injuries. Worcester's drug testing, Narcan, and the vans that offer treatment all rely on federal funding from agencies that have been cut. But so far, Worcester's programs are intact, and overdose deaths continue to drop. For NPR News, I'm Martha Biebinger in Worcester, Massachusetts.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on People Powered Radio, KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Check KAXE.org for information about food-related resources across northern Minnesota, with hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Add resources in your region by emailing news at KAXE.org. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota invites high school seniors to write an essay on the biggest need you see in your community and your ideas to address that need. Open to those in Kuching and Lake of the Woods County, plus the entire Iron Range. Find more at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The deadline is January 1st. And you can cut your own Christmas tree in the Superior or Chippewa National Forests. Permits are now available at recreation.gov. You may also stop by a district office to get a permit. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Negotiators for Ukraine are in West Palm Beach, Florida, to talk about a U.S. plan to end the fighting with Russia. They are meeting with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, and President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Indonesian authorities say a week of monsoon rains has left at least 417 people dead and thousands displaced in Sumatra. In Sri Lanka, the death toll from floods and mudslides has risen to 193, with more than 100,000 people displaced. The Trump administration is halting all asylum decisions after police say an Afghan refugee shot two National Guardsmen in Washington, D.C., one of whom has died. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us, as always, is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How are you, Will?
I'm doing great. How are you, Lauren?
Yeah, good, thanks. Will, remind us of last week's challenge.
Yes, it came from Greg Van Mechelen of Berkeley, California. I said, name some equipment an equestrian might use, remove the second, third, and fourth letters, and reverse those that remain. And the result will be some more equipment an equestrian might use. What things are these? And the answer is stirrups. You drop the T-I-R and read the rest backward, you get spurs.
Ugh, that's difficult. Nevertheless, there were 1,228 correct entries. And this week's winner is Kevin Demko of Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. Congratulations, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Lauren.
Kevin, how did you figure this one out?
Well, neither me nor my hubby are horse people, but we put our heads together and thought about horse equipment, and we didn't think that there would be a lot of horse equipment out there. And he came up with stirrups, and I looked at it, and I said, I think you're right.
How long have you been playing the puzzle?
Oh, about 11 years now, and I've just been waiting for this call for 11 years.
Well, it's great to have you on. And what do you do when you're not playing the puzzle?
everything puzzle related. Puzzles, crossword puzzles, jigsaw puzzles, word games, and just enjoying retirement.
Well, Kevin, are you ready to play the puzzle today?
I am.
Okay, take it away, Will.
All right, Kevin, we go from horses to dogs today. Every answer is the name of a breed or variety of dog. Here's your first one. What kind of dog is also a pugilist?
A boxer.
Very good. What kind of dog consists of an informal term for food said twice?
Food said
twice. It's the same word for food. It's same word said twice.
Chow chow?
Chow chow. Good job. What kind of dog would become a brand of bottled water if you changed the first letter from T to P?
Terrier.
Terrier to Perrier. Nice. What kind of dog would sound like a musical instrument if you changed the first vowel sound from long E to long U?
Long E to long U.
So I'll tell you, it's two-syllable kind of dog. It's got floppy ears, and the first vowel sound is a long E.
Long E. Beagle.
Beagle to bugle.
Beagle
good
to
job.
Bugle, yeah. Mm.
What kind of dog would become a brand of marker if you reversed the order of the last two letters?
Sharpay.
Sharpay to Sharpie. Ooh, you are sharp.
Wow. That's
what kind of dog has three H's in its nine-letter name?
Three-letter H's. Mmm.
Yes.
Chihuahua.
Chihuahua. Nice. What kind of dog contains somewhere within it the consecutive letters C-H-S-H?
Oh, Lauren, help me.
I mean, if you can spell Chihuahua, you can spell this one. I didn't know this was how you spelled it.
that may be my problem. C-H-S-H.
And it's a two-syllable name, and the first syllable ends with the S, and the second syllable starts with the H.
Oh, boy.
I think it might be a synonym.
Dachshund.
Dachshund, good job. Dachshund.
You got it.
Well, what kind of dog contains a place in Canada as part of its name?
A place in Canada as part of its name.
Think of a region, and it's in eastern Canada.
A region in eastern Canada. I failed geography in school.
Actually, there's two answers, and one of them starts with N.
N?
Newfoundland. And then there's another one that starts with L.
Another one that starts with L.
I think it connects to Newfoundland.
Labrador. Labrador Retriever.
Labrador. Good job. And here's your last one. What kind of dog is an anagram of someday? S-O-M-E-D-A-Y.
A Samoyed.
Samoyed. That was so fast.
Well, wow. Because I'm great at anagrams.
Well, I think you showed that.
Thank you. Thank you, Will. I appreciate it. I love you, and I'm so glad you're on the road to recovery because we were so scared.
Oh, thanks a lot. Well, I keep getting better and better. And
I know you
that.
Do. You're a member of our family, our NPR family, believe me.
Thank you, Kevin.
Oh, and now, Kevin, you are as well. Congratulations on playing the puzzle. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lauren.
That was Kevin Demko of Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. Okay, Will, what is next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Al Gorey of Cozy Lake, New Jersey. Name a place where games are played. Move the last two letters to the beginning. Change the new last letter to an H, and the result, sadly, is what you might have when you leave this place. So again, a place where games are played, move the last two letters to the start, change the new last letter to an H, and the result, sadly, is what you might have when you leave this place.
And when you have that answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, to submit your response. Just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, one entry per person, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, December 4th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. And if you are the winner, we will give you a call. So remember to pick up the phone. You'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thanks a lot, Lauren.
It's been a little more than a month since Hurricane Melissa became one of the strongest hurricanes in history to make landfall. Scientists say the storm was clearly influenced by climate change. People in Jamaica are worried about what that means for future storms. NPR's Eder Peralta reports.
Joseph Ray stands in front of his house looking at the hills of blue fields. 60 years he's lived here, and they've always been green. Now, as if someone poured salt over the land, they are brown.
This is outrageous. All the trees. If you light fire, everything is gonna just blaze.
Ray's home was damaged, but he's also worried about his bees.
The storm damaged the boxes, and there's one hive there. I'm not sure what happened to the other apiaries. I haven't been there yet.
Glenwick Clark, his friend, is an expert beekeeper.
Right now, what we are seeing, based on the destruction of the trees, there's no feeding surrounding for the bees.
The bees can't find food in the wild, he says, so they're venturing into homes looking for sustenance.
And it's not just the bees, you're talking about the butterfly, you're talking about the doctor birds. All of them are in danger of dying.
Clark says they are going to have to start feeding the bees to save them. Without them, he says, Jamaica's crops will also die.
No pollination, no food.
He says they can start planting fast-blossoming vegetables like cucumbers and pumpkins to give the humans and bees some relief. But the trees, that's going to take a long time.
The trees go through the same emotion as us. Yeah. You know, traumatized, stress, all of these, and this is trauma.
Scientists are still sifting through the data, but Hurricane Melissa might very well go down as the strongest Atlantic hurricane to make landfall in recorded history. Professor Michael Taylor, who studies climate change at the University of the West Indies in Kingston, says they just concluded a rapid attribution study, and one thing is clear.
There's a clear climate change imprint on Melissa.
The Caribbean Sea, for example, is much warmer than it used to be. And for hurricanes, warm waters equals fuel. Melissa intensified quickly from a tropical storm to a major hurricane in 24 hours.
I think this has broken all records. It's twice or three times the standard that you set for what rapid intensification is.
This study found that Hurricane Melissa's rapid intensification was made six times more likely because of climate change.
All right, ready?
In Black River, on the south coast of Jamaica, the St. John's Anglican Church had stood for nearly 200 years. Alison Morris used to lead historical tours of the church, and she also used to play the church's more than century-old organ. Hurricane Melissa destroyed all of it. Morris found out the day after the hurricane. She walked along the coast from her house toward the church with her daughter. The only thing left standing was the bell tower.
We just started bawling in the street. I didn't go down on my knees, but I know I was crouched. I couldn't stand. And she just came and we bawled.
Back in the day, Black River was the first town in Jamaica to have electricity. Its downtown was full of historic buildings. It survived earthquakes and hurricanes before they were even given names. But now, it's all gone. And to Morris, everything seems to have changed.
If you go up on my roof, this is the first time that we have been able to see the sea from here.
The mangroves and the big old trees are gone. Morris says this town always felt like a sanctuary, but this storm has left them shaken.
So you even wonder if we hear another Category 5 is coming, would we even stay here?
And what happens, she thinks, if the next one defies the categories? Should they even be here now? Ada Peralta, NPR News, in Western Jamaica.
Harry Potter fans have got it good lately. It seems like every week there's another Harry Potter production. There's an HBO TV show in the works. There are video games, theme parks. But if you're more of an audiobook person, you'll know the big release actually happened a few weeks ago. Audible dropped the first in its series of Harry Potter audiobooks with a full cast recording. Here to tell us more about it is NPR's book correspondent Andrew Limbong. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Lauren.
So set the stage for us. What do we need to know about this Harry Potter audiobook?
generally speaking, right, audiobooks consist of one narrator reading the entire book, right? Maybe sometimes they'll pitch their voices up or down to do different characters and stuff. This is a full cast recording, and what that means is you've got one narrator. In this case, it's actor Kush Jumbo. But then you also have different actors voicing different characters. Now, that's not a new concept, but Audible, which is the Amazon-owned audiobook and podcast company, they're really pulling out all of the stops for this production. They've got some decently famous people in it. I mean, you got Riz Ahmed playing Snape, Matthew McFadden from HBO Succession and Pride and Prejudice. They've got him as Voldemort. Speaking of Pride and Prejudice, Keira Knightley's going to show up as a voice in a later book.
Ooh, star-studded. So you've got a clip for us.
Yeah, so yeah, like you mentioned, Audible recently released the first book in the series, The Sorcerer's Stone. And I just want to give folks a bit of a setup. Lauren, are you a big Harry Potter fan?
I have to admit, I read 1.5 books.
Okay.
And I have not seen any of the movies, but I'm intrigued. Audiobooks might be what hooks me.
All right, cool. I'll give you the setup. So Harry is just a wizard, right?
I got that. Yeah. I know okay, that much. Cool.
All right, and so this is the scene after all the kids are sorted in their wizard houses, and Harry hears a speech from the headmaster, who is voiced by Hugh Laurie.
At last, the puddings too disappeared, and Professor Dumbledore got to his feet again. The hall fell silent.
Just a few more words. Now we are all fed and watered. I have a few start-of-term notices to give you.
I don't know if you caught that little, like, whoosh and the ahem there, but this thing is more than just the voice actors reading the lines. There's an original orchestral score, and there's a lot of fancy-schmancy sound design. I don't know if this is going to come through in the radio, but Lauren, if you want to turn your headphones up a bit, I'm going to play you a bit more action-packed scene to give you a sense of what's going on. This is the scene where they're playing Quidditch, which is essentially like wizard rugby on flying broomsticks.
Harry saw it. In a great rush of excitement, he dived downwards after the streak of gold. Slytherin seeker Terence Higgs had seen it too. Neck and neck, they hurtled towards the snitch.
Wow, so this is like a movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like full tracks, like sounds. Uh-huh. This is not somebody in a recording studio reading a book. This is really different from the classical style audiobook.
Yeah, I mean, just for comparison's sake, right? Here's what the old Jim Dale audiobook sounds like.
Chapter 1, The Boy Who Lived. Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of No. 4 Privet Drive were proud to say they were perfectly normal, thank you very much.
And that sounds perfectly normal, thank you very much. But exactly. You've got something different now.
Yeah, that just sounds like a guy reading a book to you, right? You know, I think some folks might actually prefer that style versus the full cast recording with all of its like whiz-bang energy.
I like the whiz-bang. The full cast recording of the second book is set to come out next month, with the rest of the book scheduled to come out through 2026. What does this say, Andrew, about the audiobook industry? Is it changing?
I mean, I think it's just a further indication that audiobooks are popping off, right? I mean, from my reporting, audiobooks is an industry that's been growing steadily for like about a decade now. And just, you know, anecdotally, I'm running into lots more people who are just telling me like, oh, I listened to that on audiobook instead of like reading it. Honestly, though, I think it says more about the Harry Potter franchise and how it still stands strong as a money-making enterprise all these years on, right? Like after an extremely successful movie franchise, they can, like you said, retell essentially the same story on TV for HBO, and then they're retelling the same story on audiobook. People are very much, you aside, still very much into Harry Potter.
This is going to do it for me. I'm going to get into the audiobooks. Yeah, a good story is a good story. That was NPR's Andrew Limbong. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Lauren.
And just a heads up, Amazon is a financial supporter of NPR and pays to distribute some of our content. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. The Bemidji Senior Center invites you to a Christmas concert with the First City Singers Monday, December 1st at 4 p.m. Starting in 2026, tax rules related to charitable giving are shifting. This means right now might be the right time to give to KAXE and other nonprofits. Check with a financial advisor to see if it is a good time for you to make a gift. Your support keeps people-powered radio strong and ensures a bright future for KAXE. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Author Series tomorrow at noon with Minnesota author Will Weaver. He will talk about his new book, Black Dirt, Bright Stars, a sequel to Power and Light. And if you or someone you know is living with Parkinson's disease, there is a support group Tuesday, December 2nd at 1 p.m. in the meeting room at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids.